All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is October 23rd, and we're going to finish up the autonomic nervous system and move on to chapter 10, which is senses. And as a reminder, don't forget, a week from tonight we have exam number 3 on chapters 7, 8, 9. And what do you got to study for that? Exam figures, what else? Yeah, the questions on the web, questions at the back of the book, and of course you've got answers for all of those. And the objectives are real handy because it focuses on what you should really learn in the chapter. Okay, and if we covered some information in lecture, that is the information that probably will be covered on the test, and that's what the end of chapter questions relate to, and the web questions and the exam figures. So yeah, it all interrelates with each other. All right, so in terms of the autonomic nervous system, let's just review a little bit. How many divisions are there?
Two.
There are two? You got to know the names. What are the names? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. And how many in an autonomic pathway from the central nervous system, how many neurons does it take to get to an effector organ?
Two.
Yeah, it requires two. What are they called? What are the neurons called? Nope. They're called the preganglionic and the postganglionic, right? And what can you tell me, what is one similarity for all the preganglionic fibers? One similarity, well, how are they all the same? There's a couple of ways. They're cholinergic. That's right. That means that they release acetylcholine. All right, so they're cholinergic. That's one way. What's another way that they're all similar? They're all fast. What makes them fast? They're myelinated axons. So the axons are myelinated. Okay. Now, the postganglionic fibers in the autonomic nervous system, that's the second one. What is one way that they're all similar? There are more ways that they're different, but there's one way that they are similar. They are slow. That's right. They're slow. What does that mean?
They're not myelinated.
That's right. So postganglionic fibers are non-myelinated. But now what are some ways they're different? What is something special about the postganglionic fiber in the parasympathetic nervous system? I don't know. Maybe. How so? What's... Oh, where they come from?
Yeah.
Cranial sacral. Yep, the brain and the sacral nerves. Okay, which is different than sympathetic, because where do they come from for the sympathetic nervous system? They are? Oh, that's parasympathetic. For sympathetic, they are thoracolumbar. Thorax and lumbar, right? T1 through L2. What about the neurotransmitter that's used for the parasympathetic postganglionic fiber? Oh yeah, you got to know which one is which. The parasympathetic is a cholinergic neuron, and the sympathetic postganglionic fibers are all adrenergic. So of course you got to know what adrenergic means. It means that it's going to release what? Norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. Okay. The receptor types, remember that different effects can be produced in the body with the same neurotransmitter. So how can one neurotransmitter have different effects in the body? Because receptors in different parts of the body might be different. What's the type of receptor within the ganglion? No, that's the neurotransmitter, but what is going to be binding that neurotransmitter in a ganglion? Whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, it doesn't matter. So it's going to be an acetylcholine ligand-gated channel, but of what kind? What type? Yeah, you're close. Well, which one is it?
It's
called nicotinic, right? In the ganglion, it's a nicotinic. And in a nicotinic receptor, is it does it produce EPSPs or IPSPs, or can it produce both?
EPSPs.
It's always going to be excitatory, right? So a nicotinic receptor is a ligand-gated channel for an ion that is going to be excitatory. What ion channel is usually excitatory?
Sodium.
It opens up and sodium goes inside the cell, and that produces... How does that change the electrical property of the cell? It depolarizes, that brings the membrane to threshold, so it is excitatory. So nicotinic receptors are excitatory. So that's what you see on this slide right here, right? All these nicotinic receptors, in every case, whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system, this is going to be an excitatory synapse producing EPSPs. All right, now let's look at the postganglionic fiber. Let's look specifically, and all of these receptors on the target organs are going to be muscarinic receptors. And what can you tell me about a muscarinic receptor? They're a little bit different than nicotinic. They're G proteins. And depending on the mechanism, they can be either. They can be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what the effector organ is. Okay, but nonetheless, everyone is muscarinic. If it's excitatory, what's a good way for you to explain why a muscarinic receptor might be excitatory? What kind of channel will open up? A sodium channel. If it's inhibitory, what kind of channel is going to open up? A potassium channel, right? That's going to hyperpolarize the cell. Okay, now for the sympathetic nervous system, we have two main types of receptors. Those are the alpha and the beta, right? Furthermore, there are subtypes of those two general types. You've got alpha 1 and alpha 2. Alpha 1 is generally what kind of receptor? Or what is the effect of an alpha 1 receptor? Is it going to be excitatory or inhibitory? It's going to be excitatory. And on smooth muscle, it's going to cause that smooth muscle to constrict or to contract. So that's what we have right here. Okay, alpha 1 adrenergic receptor going to cause vasoconstriction in the viscera and the skin, vasoconstriction of a blood vessel. So it's going to turn off blood supply to digestive organs and the skin, because the sympathetic nervous system is responsible for the flight or fight response. So if you're presented with a very stressful situation, you're either going to run away or deal with it, maybe with a physical confrontation. Where do you need blood flow going to? Digestive organs?
No.
No, because you can digest your food later after you deal with the threat. Where do you need blood flow going to? Well, of course, your brain. Okay. That hardly ever changes. That hardly is ever regulated. All right, but your heart, because your heart is your heart rate going to stay the same? No, right? It's going to increase, needs more blood flow, more oxygen. What about muscles? Muscles need blood flow too. All right, so when you're not exercising, your body turns off blood flow to muscles. It doesn't need a lot of blood flow, but when you start exercising, you need blood flow. So these alpha 1s are going to turn off blood flow to parts of your body that you do not need blood flow going to, namely your skin and digestive organs. And when there is sympathetic outflow, the beta 1 receptors will be stimulated. Beta 1s are on the heart. Again, during the fight or flight response, this will increase output from the heart, which we call cardiac output, will increase heart rate, and that will help you deal with that stressful situation. Okay, and also, if you're presented with a stressful situation, what can you tell me about breathing? Is it going to slow down or speed up? It's going to speed up, you're going to hyperventilate. And also the flow of any kind of material through a tube, whether it's a blood vessel or a tubular airway, like a bronchiole, when it dilates, you can get more flow through it. When it constricts, it reduces the flow. All right, so when you're faced with a stressful situation and you start to hyperventilate, should you have more airflow through your lungs or less? You should have more. That means that your bronchiole should dilate so that when you breathe in and out, it's easier to get air in and out of your lungs. So there we have smooth muscle, but those have beta 2 adrenergic receptors. Norepinephrine will bind to the beta 2 and that is going to inhibit these smooth muscles, causing dilation. Right? So depending on what part of the body it is, adrenergic stimulation could be excitatory or inhibitory, but it should always make sense in light of what that fight or flight response. Okay? So that's maybe just a good overall way of looking at it. And of course, you think this is an exam figure? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's really nice and simple and breaks it down. These different receptors gives you at least one concrete example of where they are and what they do in the body. Okay? So probably this figure you want to even practice labeling over the Christmas holiday so that you never forget it, okay, for the rest of your life. Yeah, you seem like that's a weird thing, but you'll run into this stuff for the rest of your life, these different receptors. Okay, question. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't explain 2 very much. Alpha 2s we find in the central nervous system, and there really is not an easy way to describe what the function of the alpha 2s do, and we're still learning maybe some different classes of alpha 2s. All right, but for instance, they can be used to adjust blood pressure, which is going to cause vasodilation. So it might be stimulatory in the brain, which eventually, though, might have an inhibitory effect on the body. So I'm not sure we can really explain how that works yet.
Okay. Alpha 1, beta 1, 2.
Yeah, but I think what the commonality, what's the common feature of the alpha type receptors? How do they work? Through calcium as a second messenger, the betas use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. Okay. So the alphas usually are always excitatory, but the alpha 2 ultimate response might be inhibitory through some mechanism that we don't understand. Well, I'm not going to tell you about. Okay. Okay. All right, let's talk about cholinergic stimulation. And so what's the neurotransmitter used in a cholinergic system? Acetylcholine, right? It's used in all motor neurons at the neuromuscular junction. And when a motor neuron releases acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, what is always going to be the effect? It's going to be excitatory. It's going to initiate contraction of that muscle, right? And so that's a nicotinic receptor, as a matter of fact, as well. All neuromuscular junctions have nicotinic receptors. All preganglionics use acetylcholine, and the receptor type is nicotinic as well, so that if you memorize this diagram, look, it says right there, all of these are nicotinic receptors in the ganglion. Okay, and furthermore, cholinergic receptors have 2 subtypes, the nicotinic, which I pointed out to you, right? It's blocked by, or no, stimulated by nicotine, blocked by, when I talked about this chemical before, curare, can block the neuromuscular junction, thereby paralyzing an animal, right? When curare is put on a little arrow or dart, and it can be used for hunting, for instance, and it's been used for thousands of years for hunting down in South America. The second class of receptors are the muscarinic. It's stimulated by muscarin, which comes from poisonous mushrooms, and can be blocked by, for instance, atropine. All right, so what about these different kinds of receptors? Nicotinic receptors are just ligand-gated sodium channels primarily, partially permeable to potassium, but the overriding effect here is going to be for sodium. So when sodium enters the cell, that is a stimulation of that cell because it causes depolarization and excitation or producing EPSPs. Muscarinic receptors, on the other hand, might be either excitatory or inhibitory depending on the ion channel that it is working on, and it depends on the particular tissue. So here's a muscarinic receptor in the heart when acetylcholine binds, and in this case only one. But for a nicotinic receptor, it's got to bind 2 acetylcholines. The G protein will dissociate, and it will float around in the membrane. And when it bumps into this protein, it will change a conformation in this membrane protein. And this is specifically a potassium channel. So now the potassium channel opens up. Potassium can leave the cell, causing what kind of electrical event inside the cell? Hyperpolarization. What's hyperpolarization? And is that going to produce an IPSP or EPSP? That's the iPSP, which is going to inhibit that cell. And in the heart, right, that is going to slow the heart rate down. So this muscarinic receptor opens up a potassium channel. But for instance, if we look into a different part of the body, like for instance, smooth muscle of the digestive tract, when acetylcholine is released, binds to this G-protein coupled receptor, the G-protein can diffuse around in this membrane. It can bind, bump into one of two kinds of membrane proteins, either a potassium channel or, for instance, a sodium or calcium channel. When it bumps into the potassium channel, it causes it to close, right? And in this particular case, under the normal resting conditions, this potassium channel is open. So if the potassium channel is open in the resting case, what is the resting membrane potential, or what is this channel doing when the cell is in the resting case, when it's open? Yeah, when a potassium channel is open, what does it produce? What is it producing?
Sodium.
Nope, it's a potassium channel.
Closing?
Yeah, when the potassium closes, or if you open up a potassium channel, what happens to the membrane potential when you have a potassium channel open? Potassium goes out. What does that cause? Hyperpolarization. So is that a stimulus or is that an inhibition? That's an inhibition. So in the normal resting case, when this potassium channel is open, this smooth muscle cell is being inhibited because the potassium channel is open. But when acetylcholine binds and the G-protein bumps into the open potassium channel, it closes it. So instead of hyperpolarizing the cell, closing of this potassium channel actually depolarizes it, so it is excitatory. Right? Another example of maybe causing depolarization is the G-protein bumps into this sodium or a calcium channel, causing it to open. Calcium is high on the outside, sodium is high on the outside. When cations enter the cell, that causes depolarization, and does that produce EPSPs or IPSPs? So that is excitatory, causing muscle contraction. So in either of these cases, closing of a potassium channel or opening of a sodium or calcium channel, that causes depolarization or excitation of the smooth muscle of the digestive tract. All right, so why does calcium produce depolarization? Why does a calcium ion produce depolarization? Because it's a cation, just like sodium. But it's a divalent cation, so it depolarizes even faster when it enters the cell. Okay, so muscarinic receptors can either hyperpolarize or depolarize depending on the kind of channel proteins that are inserted into the membrane of that particular tissue. Any questions on this? So this is going to be important when we talk about the heart later on, because our body adjusts heart rate all the time, right, through these muscarinic receptors, for instance. Okay, so just like in the adrenergic system, we have different receptor types. In the cholinergic system, we have different receptor types. The nicotinic receptors are always going to be stimulatory by opening cation channels, right, causing depolarization in skeletal muscle and autonomic ganglia. And those are the two places where we find nicotinic receptors, not in the postganglionic system. But postganglionic fibers have muscarinic receptors. And for instance, we see a couple subtypes. The M2 we find in the heart that causes hyperpolarization, which inhibits the heart, right? That slows the rate of depolarization of the heart, which slows the heart rate, right? These M3 and 5 we find in smooth muscles. These depolarize and contraction of smooth muscle and gland. So these are what? Stimulatory, because they open calcium channels, increasing cytosolic calcium. Okay. I don't think I'm going to talk much about this other than you should probably hear about some of these things. All right, so we learned that in the sympathetic nervous system, the neurotransmitter typically is, in the postganglionic, is norepinephrine. For the parasympathetic nervous system, it is acetylcholine. But there are some parts of the autonomic nervous system that don't use either. We call these non-adrenergic, non-cholinergic fibers when we're just beginning to learn about some of these things. Some appear to use ATP that's released. I don't even know what VIP is. Look that up in your book. What's VIP? Anybody know what VIP? Huh? Vasomotor inhibitory peptide. Okay. Nitric oxide. And these might be inhibitory or excitatory, but nitric oxide is inhibitory on smooth muscle of blood vessels in some tissues, for instance, like the penis. When an erection occurs, it causes dilation of blood vessels, blood pools in the penis, and that produces an erection. All right, so you can probably imagine what the effect of Viagra would be. Right, it's going to increase nitric oxide. Okay. Most visceral organs, like the heart, digestive tract, etc., receive dual innervation. That means it's supplied both by the sympathetic and parasympathetic, which also means what? That control is antagonistic on those organs, and that's really a good thing because it provides for precise control and balance of that particular organ. But that's not always the case. Oops. That's not always the case, but that's usually the case. Oh, and you had a table that showed where... this one right here. Okay, so for instance, on the heart, you see nice dual innervation. Okay, for pupil constriction or dilation, that's dual innervation. The ciliary muscle for accommodation, for allowing you to focus up close or far away at different times, that's under antagonistic. But there's one that you see is not under antagonistic control, and that is blood vessels. Okay. Sympathetic stimulation is stimulatory. That's the alpha ones, right? It dilates in a few places of the body, okay? And that would be due to the parasympathetic. But the parasympathetic nervous system doesn't go very many places to adjust vasoconstriction in your body. Just basically one organ that I know about. Okay, so I think we covered this topic. If that dual innervation that produces antagonistic control provides for a very well-controlled mechanism, for instance, for controlling something like your heart rate, what can you tell me about blood pressure? Is blood pressure control problematic in the human population? Is there a disease associated with blood pressure? And is it prevalent? Yeah, what's it called? Hypertension. And sometimes it can be very difficult to treat. And if you look at the autonomic nervous system, is it controlled via antagonism or a tonic mechanism? What does tonic mean? With just one, either turn it on or off or somewhere in between, as opposed to a balanced control through antagonistic mechanism. And you see that vasoconstriction right here, blood vessels, is only under tonic control. All right, so if the sympathetic nervous system drifts one way or the other, there's no parasympathetic effects to counteract that drift or that error signal. So that's probably why hypertension is very prevalent in humans, because it's not dually innervated. It's only innervated through the sympathetic nervous system, okay, causing vasoconstriction. And how does vasoconstriction, again, change blood pressure? Think of that balloon. If you have a balloon in your hands, and if you want to increase the pressure in the balloon, what do? Pull the balloon apart like this or squeeze down on it? You actually squeeze down. If you squeeze down on it, the pressure goes up. That's what would be like vasoconstriction of a blood vessel, increasing the pressure. And to release that pressure, just release that squeezing or the vasoconstriction of the balloon, and the pressure will go down. Okay, so that's it for your test on here. That's a nice slide, actually, because you can see what kind of fiber is this going to the adrenal medulla. And is that different than most? Nope. Vagus goes to the heart to slow it down. Okay. But look at this fiber. Is it a preganglionic or postganglionic? It should be a post. But look, here are all solid colored nerves. And what is this one here? That's a solid colored one as well. It's not dotted. It's not a dashed line. So this is a preganglionic fiber. You can see it leaving the spinal cord. going right through the sympathetic chain, even right through the collateral ganglion, going to the adrenal gland. So it never synapses on the way there. So don't forget that these cells of the adrenal medulla act as the postganglionic fibers that are releasing epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the blood. Okay, well, the usual outflow of autonomic nervous system activity requires two neurons. You've got the preganglionic, and then a ganglion, and then the postganglionic fiber. The blue just represent parasympathetic, and the red just represent sympathetic. But in every case, you got a preganglionic fiber and a post. You got a myelinated and a non-myelinated. But for innervation of the adrenal medulla, look, it's always just a preganglionic fiber. It never passes, it never synapses in a ganglion before it gets to the target organ. This target organ is the adrenal medulla, and the adrenal medulla is actually what? The ganglion. But inside that adrenal medulla, those medullary cells don't transmit electrical impulses anywhere. They just automatically do what? There's no synapse there. They just release norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood, which then goes everywhere in the body, continuing that sympathetic effect everywhere that the blood goes to. Okay, so that's just a nice backup signal for sympathetic stimulation. So this pathway right here doesn't have a postganglionic fiber. That's what's interesting about it. Okay. All right, so again, we see it right here. Here's the adrenal medulla. I only see a preganglionic cell. Don't see a postganglionic cell. These modified postganglionic cells automatically just release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the circulation, which then bind to adrenergic receptors everywhere in the body, producing that sympathetic response. Okay. Okay. So I think that's it for this particular chapter. All right, senses chapter 10. All right, so this is kind of a fun chapter. We're going to start talking about senses in terms of sensory receptors, but I suppose you should just automatically think of a response loop when we talk about the sensory system, okay, and it's going to participate in the first part of a response loop. So what are the parts of a response loop? Stimulus. It always starts with a stimulus. The stimulus is going to somehow affect a receptor, okay, and the receptor is going to send a signal, afferent pathway, to the central nervous system or the brain, right, and then the brain is going to make a decision via some interneurons, compare information to a set point, send it out a motor neuron to an effector, which is going to produce the last thing in a response loop, which is the response, right? So you got a stimulus and causing a response. Oh, and then the last thing, that response is going to feed back with the stimulus. And there's two ways it can feed back. What are the two ways it can feed back? Negative feedback or positive feedback, which usually produces a healthy state. The negative feedback where the response subtracts from the stimulus, bringing you back toward the set point. Right. Okay, so we're talking about receptors in that response loop. And so what a receptor does is that it transduces a signal. It changes a signal from one kind of energy to another kind of energy. All right, so it's going to change environmental information into action potentials. Because remember, that's how your brain, that's the language of your brain, action potential. It's not the height of the action potential, it's not the duration, it's the what about action potentials, that your brain understands how the intensity is changing. Frequency. The frequency, right, frequency coding. And your brain understands what the modality of that energy is, whether it's sound energy or light energy or pressure energy, because of what part of the brain it goes to. So if it goes to the occipital lobe, you have what, the perception of hearing or pressure or taste? It's vision, right? That's where you deal with photons, right? Visual information, light energy. All right, what about hearing? What part of the brain, when it receives action potentials, gives you the perception of sound? That's the temporal lobe. Right, so if we took those same neurons, instead of going to the temporal lobe, if we took them to the occipital lobe, even though they're coming from your ear, what would you perceive? Let me say it again. If we take neurons that come from your ear, which normally go to your temporal lobe, but now we unplug them from the temporal lobe and plug them into the occipital lobe, when a sound hits your ear, what would be your perception? Okay. It wouldn't be sound. It would be vision. You would see things. Okay? Yeah, you would see sound. And it happens to some people. I forgot what that syndrome is called. Okay? It might not be sound to hearing or whatever, but what I'm trying to reinforce is, all right, your perception of a modality of sense is not due to the organ that perceives it. It's due to what? The action potentials in which part of your cerebral cortex, right, or depolarizations in what part of your cerebral cortex are depolarizing. So, should I give you another example? If we take neurons that come from your nose, which is smell, and instead of going to the insula, which is your smell or temporal lobe, sorry, it's temporal lobe too, unplug them from the temporal lobe and put them in the occipital lobe, when you get an odorant molecule in your nose, what will be your perception? You're going to see odorant molecules instead of have that sense of smell, whatever smell is. I don't know what smell is. It's just, right, something we smell. I don't know how to describe it much more than that. So it's the part of the brain that depolarizes that gives you that perception of reality, not the receptor.
So the people that have that kind of disease, is it like what you're saying? Like it's pretty much somewhere else, like their neurons?
The neural anatomy? I'm going to have to do a Google, and I'm going to have to refresh my memory what that disease process is called. And which senses get maybe reversed or complemented or confused, okay? Chances are the place where things got miswired, there's a relay center in your brain that determines where sensory input, where it goes within the cerebral cortex. And that you have to know for the test, okay? There is a nucleus deep inside your brain that will take sensory information and it will direct it to the appropriate part of the cerebral cortex so that you have the appropriate sensation, so that photons go, right, that cause depolarizations go to the occipital lobe, that action potentials that originate from your ear go to your temporal lobe, where sensations on your skin, where do sensations on your skin end up? Or where should they end up? What gyrus? Of what lobe? Okay, the precentral is motor, because that's where the motor of your car is, so it's not that. It's not motor, it's the postcentral gyrus of the parietal lobes. Okay, so that's where you have, and don't forget, you have that little homuncular guy on the postcentral gyrus, so that's how the surface of your body maps to the surface of your brain. Right? So it depends on the exact location of those neurons in the cerebral cortex. All right, well, let's get back to sensory receptors. They change environmental information into action potentials, because that's how your brain appreciates things. That's the only way that your brain can appreciate information, as action potentials. And don't forget, all action potentials are the same. The only thing that changes is where they are in the brain and the frequency. As the frequency goes up, your brain perceives that as an increase in intensity. So the frequency of action potentials is directly related to the intensity of the stimulus. All right, so each type responds to a particular modality. For instance, you have certain receptors that respond to light. You have other receptors that respond to pressure. Pressure receptors don't respond to light very well. And light receptors don't respond to pressure very well, but they sort of do sometimes. Okay? If you've ever hit your head and it deformed your retina momentarily, you probably saw something. What did you see? You saw stars, right, or a flash of light or something. So other kinds of stimuli can stimulate other receptors. It's just they don't do a very good job at it. Okay. So yeah, it actually causes depolarization of some neurons inside the cell. I was going to maybe tell you to do that, but I don't want anybody poking themselves too hard in the eye. There's probably something bad that can happen. Okay? It's just like your mother when you were young and you would cross your eyes. What would she always say? Don't cross your eyes because they could get stuck. Yeah, so don't put your fingers in your eyes causing those flashes because something might, you know, just on your eyelid. Yeah, right. Okay. Okay, so different modalities are perceived as different because why? Not because they're different receptors, because they send action potentials to different parts of the brain, right, that give you that sense. All right, so some receptors can be really simple dendritic neurons, endings of neurons. Others are very specialized endings of neurons, or even non-neuronal cells. So we're going to show you some of these. For instance, a Pacinian corpuscle right here is a very specialized kind of nerve ending. But other nerve endings, like these right here, are free nerve endings. Free nerve endings work as nociceptors. That means that they sense tissue damage. And what is your sense of tissue damage called? Pain. That's right, pain. Okay. So temperature and pain are free nerve endings. All right. So we can also classify receptors by these different types right here. Chemoreceptors sense different chemicals that are dissolved in your body's solutions. All right, so what are some chemicals that your body can sense because of chemoreceptors? You've got one right there. Yeah, what's sweet? Glucose, like glucose, for instance. There are glucose receptors in the pancreas for releasing insulin. Probably we'll talk about that in the next chapter, which is endocrinology. You also have pH receptors. What's a pH a measure of? Yeah, it's just a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. That's just a chemical. A hydrogen ion is just a chemical. So pH is measured in your body by a chemoreceptor in different parts of your body. You have photoreceptors. Where you got that? In your eyes. Thermoreceptors. Where do you have thermoreceptors?
Everywhere.
Pretty much everywhere, right? Mechanoreceptors respond to the deformation of a cell or a cell membrane. And so they measure physical responses. So tension in a muscle is a mechanoreceptor, position of a joint or twisting of a joint capsule. Pressure receptors and vibration receptors in your skin are mechanoreceptors. And even for hearing, sound is a mechanical wave, an alternating wave of high pressure and low pressure, which causes changes in the cell membrane. And so hearing is a result of a mechanoreceptor. Mechanoreceptors, yeah, can be all over your body. But not hearing receptors. Those aren't all over your body. So depending on which kind of mechanoreceptor it is, it may or may not be all over your body. All right. Nociceptors respond to pain or tissue damage is probably a better way of saying that. Respond to tissue damage. So when you rip a cell open, it releases compounds like histamine, for instance, or substance P that's going to stimulate nerve endings, and that's going to give you the perception of pain, which is tissue damage. And of course, that's really good, right? Because if you didn't have that system, if you were damaging your body, you couldn't tell, and you couldn't take your body away from that damaging stimulus, which would be terrible. And that does happen to people, too, where they don't sense pain. So they can damage their body severely and not even know it. Proprioceptors signal positional information of body parts. So you know what position your arms are in, your legs, your head, your hand. So for instance, if I asked somebody to close their eyes and I took control of their arm and put their hand over their head with their eyes closed and asked them where their hand was, they would tell me, oh, well, my left hand is down by my side and my right hand is up over my head, even with their eyes closed, because of proprioceptors. So all muscles, all joints, all tendons and ligaments have proprioceptors in them. And these are just a special case of mechanoreceptors right here. Okay. We can also categorize receptors by their location. Cutaneous receptors are going to be in the skin. And furthermore, I would like to say, you know, I would like to change this in your book. Instead of saying cutaneous, I maybe would like to say general receptors. Say general. as opposed to special. All right, so a general receptor usually is in your skin, and they respond to touch, pressure, temperature, and pain. And we say general receptors because if I took an ice cube, which is going to stimulate a certain kind of receptor, what kind of receptor is that going to stimulate primarily? It might stimulate pain, but I would hopefully think you would say, well, temperature receptor, right? So if I took an ice cube and put it on the tip of your nose, could you tell it was cold? What about your earlobe? What about your belly button? Yeah, kneecap, back of your knee, on your back. No matter where I put that ice cube, you could say, oh, yeah, well, that's an ice cube. That's cold. So, huh? Yeah, even on your elbow. But temperature, you could pinch that. Okay. Yeah, eventually it's going to hurt. It's going to tell you about... Yeah, it's going to tell you that there's tissue damage going on there. All right, so where do you have temperature receptors? Everywhere on your skin, right? No matter where we put that ice cube, you can tell me that that's an ice cube going there. The same thing for touch, right? And for pain. If I had a pin, right, and I poked you on your earlobe, could you tell? Yeah, what about your shoulder? Or your kneecap, belly button? No matter where that pin was, you could tell me. You might not be able to tell me exactly where it is, but you can say, well, there's a pin someplace in this general area of my body. So pressure and pain receptors, where do you have? All over your body. And if you have a receptor everywhere on your body or all over, the density might change from one region to another, but if generally speaking you have receptors all over your body, we call that a general sense. That's a general sense. As opposed to a special sense. Special senses are due to special sensory organs that you have in only one or two places in your body. So a special sense would be hearing. Because if I were to take a tuning fork or something and put it on your kneecap, will your kneecap hear that tuning fork? Or on your nose? No. Okay, or on your elbow. But you can only hear with your ear, two locations. So that's it's a special organ. It has a lot of special structures in there. All right, and how about if I took a flashlight and I shined it on your belly button, could you see the light? No. Or your elbow, or your kneecap. It has to be only on your eyes, right? So again, only two locations are you sensitive to light. Those are your eyes, so that's a special sense. It's not ubiquitous all over your body, right? So it's the same thing for taste. If I took a sugar cube, put it on your kneecap, could you taste it? Fingertip. No, only on your tongue, so that's a special sense. What about for smell? If I took perfume, put it on your belly button or your kneecap or elbow or whatever, could you smell it? Fingertip. But only if it evaporated and went where? Into your nose, right? So again, there's only one place in your body where you can sense odorant molecules, and that's your nose. So that's a special sense. So general sense means you have receptors all over, special senses, one or two special locations which have relatively sophisticated organs responsible for that kind of modality. All right, okay. And as a matter of fact, probably we should fill in this slide right here. Hearing is a special sense. Sight is a special sense. Taste is the same thing as gustatory sensation. Gustatory is one. Smell is another. What's smell? Olfaction. We don't do much in lab with these, but I suppose we should have different odorant molecules and tastant molecules. All right, so We've got hearing, we've got sight, we've got gustation, olfaction, and equilibrium. Equilibrium is the sense of either linear acceleration or angular acceleration, and that's associated with your ears. So only two organs on either side of your head can appreciate acceleration. And there are two kinds of equilibrium. There's something called static equilibrium. And this is for linear acceleration. And the second kind of equilibrium is what we call kinetic and I'm just going to abbreviate this EQ. This is for angular. Acceleration. What's another? So linear acceleration is just like stopping and starting when you're going in a straight line, whether you're moving right or left or in front or in back of you or up and down. But what about angular acceleration? What's kind of a common everyday word for angular acceleration, which you used to do when you were just a little kid? So I'm sure maybe somebody in here did this last night. Is spinning. Who said spinning? Somebody said spinning. I heard spinning. So spinning is rotation, right? So when you're a kid, and at least one person last night did what? Started spinning and spinning and spinning, then stop and open your eyes, and what does the world look like? Like it's going back the opposite way you were spinning, but it continues spinning for a little bit. That's due to a funny kind of function of this apparatus for kinetic equilibrium that you have in your ears. Okay. All right, so who did this last night? Oh, you did? Okay. Question. Question? Yeah, question. Do you have a question? No?
Can you say what linear is again?
Linear is, for instance, when you're just stationary and you start to move in a direction. And that direction can be in front of you or back of you, but no spinning at all. It's just moving in one direction, or right or left. Or maybe when you're in an elevator and you start to go up and down, okay, that's just linear acceleration. Or you're driving in a car, when you stop, that would be deceleration, okay, so either when you start or when you stop motion from happening.
Your whole body has to move, so like if you were twisting, would that be angular, or is that...
Your head has to move.
Like this?
No, that's spinning.
So that's
this would be linear, like okay. This. Okay, that's
so
gonna.
If you went full side,
that's linear.
Okay,
but doing this is a rotation. Okay, that's a small rotation. That's just a rotation. Okay, so let's talk about generally two kinds of receptors that we have in the body, and I think you might be familiar with this already since you've had sensory labs. There are tonic receptors and phasic receptors. Tonic receptors respond at a constant rate as long as the stimulus is applied. So for instance, we got two different cases, case A and B. Here is a resting membrane potential. If we apply a stimulus right here, we can see that it is at least a threshold stimulus because it's why? It's producing action potential, right? So if we turn the stimulus on and we keep it at a constant amplitude and then turn it off, what can you tell me about the amplitude of the action potentials? Stays the same. What about the width of the action potentials? Stays the same because that's what an action potential is. But furthermore, what can you tell me about the frequency of action potentials right here? It stays the same, okay? So this is what we call a tonic receptor or a slow adapting receptor or a receptor that doesn't adapt whatsoever. All right, so don't forget, we turned the stimulus on here, turned it off here, but we kept it constant. We didn't change the stimulus at all. And as long as we don't change the stimulus, the frequency of action potentials does not change. So it is relaying to the brain, what? A constant level of information. So your perception of the stimulus is constant. It's not changing. All right, as opposed to a phasic receptor, we apply stimulus, keep it the same intensity, and then turn it off. So again, because these are action potentials, the height doesn't change, the width doesn't change, but this is a fast adapting kind of receptor. What happens to the frequency of action potentials as we keep the stimulus on? And we're not even changing the stimulus. We're just turning it on, keeping it the same, then turning it off. What about the frequency? It is decreasing. So what is your brain perceiving? Less stimulus is being applied to this receptor right here. Because remember, the way that our cerebral cortex understands stimulus intensity is by frequency coding. As the frequency increases, the intensity of the stimulus increases. That's what our perception is. So this receptor right here is already making its mind up for our cortex to what? To start to ignore this particular stimulus. So the intensity is decreasing even though or your appreciation of the stimulus is decreasing even though the stimulus intensity is the same. We call that a phasic receptor. It's fast adapting. So what kind of receptors might we want to put in one of each of these two kinds of categories? What kind of receptor do you think you would always like to know? You'd never like for it to adapt. You'd never like to habituate that particular stimulus. You'd always like to know that it is there, no matter how long it's applied for. Like, for instance, like for pain, for nocive-type stimuli, kinds of stimuli that are producing damage to your body, you would like to know if that damage is occurring so that you can alleviate that situation, prevent that damage from happening to your body. So pain receptors are tonic receptors. They hardly adapt one way or the other. But other kinds of receptors, and you're probably familiar with this, maybe you've walked into a building or something. There's a building that has usually a characteristic smell. That's a library. It just smells like books or something, right? And as soon as you walk into the library, it has that characteristic smell. And you go, oh, yeah, I'm at the library. You can tell even with your eyes closed. But after 5 minutes, do you smell the library anymore? You know what? And that's because the olfactory receptors are phasic receptors. They're rapidly adapting. And so that stimulus is just not being passed on to the olfactory cortex for your appreciation. So what's adapting is not the neuron. It's not the cortex. It is the receptor itself. So that's probably something important. Maybe you got quizzed on that point in lab. I'm not sure. So what is adapting is the receptor, not any of the synapses, not the neurotransmitter, not the cortex, but it's the receptor that is adapting to that stimulus. And also touch is important. That's a rapidly adapting kind of receptor because, for instance, when you first put on your shoes in the morning and your clothes, you feel those clothes going on, shoes going on, but if you felt those sensations all day long, it would probably drive you nuts, right? So those are rapidly adapting, as long as they're not producing what?
Pain.
Yes, tissue damage. If they start to produce tissue damage, then of course, that's not going to go away until you resolve that situation. Okay, so there's a law of specific nerve energies. And that just is due to stimulation of sensory fiber, all right, or a stimulation of a sensory nerve fiber evokes only the sensation of that particular modality. So for instance, those nerve fibers that go to the auditory cortex can only produce the sense of sound, of hearing something. The nerve fibers that go to the occipital lobe only give you the sense of vision. And the stimulus for activating a receptor, a particular receptor, whether it's a mechanical receptor or a chemoreceptor or a photoreceptor, we call that an adequate stimulus. All right, so the adequate stimulus is the normal stimulus for a particular kind of receptor. It requires the least amount of energy to activate it. So for instance, the photoreceptor cells in your retina. What's the adequate stimulus for photoreceptor cells in your retina? It's going to be? Well, those are the cells, the rod cells or cone cells. What are they going to be most sensitive to?
Oh, the light.
Yeah, light, photons, electromagnetic radiation within that's the right kind of energy bandwidth. Okay, but you can also cause those cells to depolarize by doing what? Which it's not an adequate stimulus, by poking yourself in the eye. Okay, for instance, a mechanical change of those membranes, of those rod and cone cells. All right, so that's not an adequate stimulus. The adequate stimulus for a photoreceptor would be what? Photons or light energy. And for mechanoreceptors, it's going to be some kind of mechanical force. Or a chemoreceptor, it's got to be a particular kind of chemical that's going to cause depolarization, that's going to be sent to cortex for appreciation. You know, somewhere I missed something. I forgot where it was in here. There are two other ways that we can classify receptors in the body. Receptors that measure things out in the environment are things that we call exteroreceptors. Things that measure things that are happening inside the body are called interoreceptors. So, for instance, pH receptors, are they extero or interoreceptors? Yeah, because you're not interested in measuring pH. I suppose maybe you could be interested in measuring pH outside your body, but that's usually not an important life-threatening situation, unless you're in a chemistry lab or something. But usually, huh? Or unless you pour acid on yourself, yeah. If you're a battery mechanic or something, I don't know, pretty rare circumstances. But you're interested in pH inside your body, so that pH receptor is an interoceptor, as opposed to another kind of chemoreceptor, which is used for olfaction. It's measuring odors, okay, in the outside environment. So that would be an exteroceptor. So that's another way that we can talk about receptors. All right, receptors cause stimulation due to changing a membrane potential, okay? And these kinds of potentials, so we learned different kinds of potentials already. Resting membrane potential, graded potentials due to ligand-gated channels, and then action potentials. What are action potentials due to? Ooh, this is a good question for the test coming up. What kind of membrane protein produces an action potential? Maybe. But oh, I think maybe you said it. Voltage-gated channels. That's right. When the membrane voltage reaches threshold, it opens up a sodium channel. What does that cause? That causes depolarization. All right? And then it also causes the opening of a potassium channel, but they're sluggish. They open up more slowly. What does that cause when a potassium channel opens up? Yeah, it causes repolarization or hyperpolarization, right? That's the two parts of an action potential. Okay, but in receptors, they produce what we call generator potentials. Generator potentials, you can see, have different amplitudes. So these are very much like graded potentials, right? Because a graded potential can have different amplitudes, and they die away over time. So the receptor will be on a dendrite someplace, and if the generator potential is of sufficient amplitude, that can trigger voltage-gated channels and an action potential on this initial segment of an axon. So sensory receptor equivalents are equivalents of EPSPs, right? They're excitatory. And the height of this generator potential, or the amplitude of a generator potential, is directly related to the stimulus intensity. So they're produced in response to an adequate stimulus. All right, so generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. As the intensity, as the stimulus increases, what can you tell me about the amplitude? It increases as well, right? Okay. After threshold is reached, the action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of a generator potential, right? But in phasic receptors, a generator potential adapts, actually decreases to constant stimulus and quickly diminishes in amplitude. All right, so let's look at this slide right here. We have three lines that we want to look at. We're just going to look at tracing when a nerve axon fires an action potential. And look, all these action potentials are the same height, same width, right? So that's a nice action potential. Here we see different generator potentials. These are produced by what? Different stimuli or different intensity of stimuli. So here's the lowest intensity, here's a medium intensity, and here's a high intensity. And this low intensity stimulus, how could we talk about this low intensity stimulus in terms of producing an action potential? What would we call that? Okay, it's a, this stimulus right here is what, does it reach threshold? So we would call this a sub-threshold stimulus. It's going to produce this generator potential right here that doesn't reach threshold, so is that going to produce an action potential? No. All right, but if we increase the stimulus intensity, what happens to the generator potential intensity? It increases as well, right? So they're directly related to each other. And in this region right here, it's going to trigger action potentials because it's above threshold, but these action potentials are going to be far apart. How come these action potentials are far apart? You would have to look at this action potential right here. So when we look at that action potential, what do we really see? Okay? So here is just time on this axis. Here is membrane voltage. What's another name for voltage? Potential. All right, so here is RMP. That's a resting membrane potential. And what's this first part? And we're going to look at an action potential. Here's the threshold voltage, so what's that called? That's a stimulus, right? How do we produce a stimulus normally? We inject, what do we inject into the cell? Some kind of cation, right? We can inject a cation into the cell that's going to depolarize it, and if it reaches threshold, causes depolarization and repolarization. But what can you tell me about that repolarization? Does it just go to RMP? No, it doesn't. It hyperpolarizes because these channels are slow. The potassium channels are slow. And what do we call this area right here? That's a kind of a refractory period. It's hyperpolarization, I agree. But what kind of refractory period is it? As opposed to this refractory period. This is absolute and this is relative. So we can still stimulate this neuron into firing another action potential, but it can't be this stimulus here, okay, because it won't reach threshold. It has to be a greater stimulus. All right, so those action potentials on the first line, on the top line right here, are far apart because those action potentials, don't forget, have this relative refractory period. And this stimulus, this threshold stimulus, is not enough to overcome the relative refractory period. So when is the next time for stimulus number two? When's the next time that it can issue another action potential on this axon? It's not until way out over here someplace. Right? So if the stimulus comes again, right, an action potential can ensue. Now let's look at the third case. Why are these action potentials so close together? Another way of saying, why is the frequency of action potentials so high right here? Why are these action potentials so close together? Yeah, because look at this intensity of the stimulus right here. Even when we're in the relative refractory period, that stimulus is way big enough, right, to reach threshold, which is going to cause an action potential over here, instead of waiting for that relative refractory period to go away. So this is much faster in time compared to farther apart in time because of the stimulus intensity and how it interacts with the relative refractory period. And that's what your brain understands. Okay, just the rate of action potentials reaching a certain part of the brain. And it's just going to be click, 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 and a higher intensity is going to be click, 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 click. That's how your brain talks to each other. Okay, cutaneous sensations. Again, why don't we just say general sensations? You have these where? Everywhere, all over your body. Include touch, pressure, heat, cold, pain, mediated by free and encapsulated nerve endings. The free nerve endings are important for temperature and pain. So you have both cold and hot free nerve endings, and of course you have nerve endings for pain. Cold receptors are in the superficial dermis. Warm are deeper in the dermis. But again, these are just free nerve endings. These are a little bit funny. Sometimes you can get a paradoxical sense. Have you ever been in the shower and you kind of had a hot and then somebody flushed the toilet and it got really hot? All right? And so you felt the hot, but you also get a sensation of cold. That's what we call a paradoxical sensation, because you were stimulating the warm receptors in the dermis with the hot water, but the cold receptors also are stimulated. They're stimulated by cold, but they're also stimulated by real hot. So that gives. So when they send action potentials to the cold part of your brain interprets that as a cold sensation, even though it was the hot stimulus that was causing that perception. So that's called a paradoxical sensation. So very hot, you can get the sensation of both hot and cold at the same time. Okay, pain receptors, pain is mediated by nociceptors. They use glutamate and substance P as a neurotransmitter. So substance P is called the pain neurotransmitter, not the brain neurotransmitter, but pain neurotransmitter. These receptors are also stimulated by a chemical called capsaicin. And that's what's found in hot chili peppers. So when that chemical binds to these receptors. It sends action potentials to the part of the brain that interprets action potentials as what? Hot, burning sensation. So chemical hot, or find what we capsaicin, doesn't cause burning of the skin. It just triggers the sensation that something is burning. Okay, so it doesn't produce temperature tissue damage. Ruffini's endings, where do we have Ruffini? Right here, right? And Merkel's discs, which are tiny, tiny little things up over here, are slow adapting, just free nerve endings. So these are just expanded free nerve endings right here. They're slow adapting so that they're, what, more sensitive to more painful kinds of stimuli. They mediate touch. Encapsulated nerve endings like the Pacinian corpuscle right here and Meissner's corpuscle over here, a little bit more complicated. These are rapidly adapting receptors. So these are for deep pressure and vibration. And those are the kinds of senses that you don't feel for a really long period of time. For instance, if you take your fingertip and have somebody pinch it really hard, first you're going to feel that deep pressure, and it might be painful for about 10 or 15 seconds, and then if they keep the pressure applied, you won't feel it anymore. Okay, as long as you're not really damaging that tissue, because those Pacinian corpuscles are rapidly adapting. So what kind of receptors are rapidly adapting? They have Pacinian, but in terms of, are they tonic or are they the phasic kind? They're the phasic kind. Yeah, so Pacinian is a phasic kind of receptor. Okay. So this just kind of goes over some of the different kinds of cutaneous or general receptors. This slide right here, what I want to take for you to take home on this slide right here. Somatesthetic senses. Whenever we talk about a somatic sense, we usually mean it refers to some surface on your body, right? So it's almost like a cutaneous sense. It's relating to the surface of your body. And in particular, the lateral spinal thalamic tract is the important pathway that mediates pain, okay? And the anterior spinal thalamic tract isn't for pain, it's more for touch and pressure. And these eventually go to the thalamus and then on to the postcentral gyrus for your appreciation of pain on the surface of your body according to that homuncular diagram. Is this a sensory pathway or a motor pathway, and how do you know? Spinothalamic means it starts in the spinal cord and it goes to the thalamus, and it's a job of the thalamus, right? That's the relay center for sensory information. The thalamus is going to tell where those action potentials should go on the surface of the brain. If it's a visual signal, it's going to go to the occipital lobe, right? If it's an auditory signal, it's going to go to the temporal lobe. If it's coming from the surface of your body, pain, temperature, vibration, it's going to go to the postcentral gyrus, right? The primary somatosensory cortex of the brain. All right, so just remember the lateral spinal thalamic tract is the pain tract. And you guys have dealt with this already, and that is receptive field. The receptive field is the area on the skin whose stimulation results in changes of the firing rate of a sensory neuron. So the area varies inversely with the density of receptors. So the receptive field gets large, okay, when the receptor density decreases. So parts of your body that don't have many sensory receptors have very poor two-point discrimination because the receptive field is large, right? And that's due to decreased density of receptors. So places where you have large receptive fields or small density or a decreased density of receptors would be probably the back of the leg, okay, your back. But areas that have a high density of receptors, giving you a small receptive field where you have very good two-point discrimination, would be your fingertips and lips in particular. Okay? Okay, you guys have done that already. Okay. Chemical senses. Oh, this is the fun one. But unfortunately, we're almost going to have to take a break real soon. Okay. Taste and smell. These receptors are exteroreceptors because they respond to chemicals in the environment, not inside your body, right? Interoceptors respond to chemicals that are in the internal environment. I'll just say a little bit about gustation or taste before we take a break. Okay, so where do you taste things? Only on your tongue. So is that a general or a special sense? That's special because you have receptors only on your tongue. And on your tongue you have little things, bless you, you have taste buds. And here is what makes up a taste bud. We have a gustatory cell or a taste cell, and it's got these little hairs or cilia. They're almost like cilia poking off the top of them onto the surface of your tongue. And this little orifice right here is what we call a taste pore. So a molecule has to dissolve in your saliva and enter this taste pore and bind, in some cases, to a receptor on the membrane of this cilium right here in order for you to perceive that taste. But now this structure right here, right, here's a cell, here's a cell, here's a cell, right, and I see some support cells. Is this a large structure or a microscopic structure? Yeah, that one right there that we see. It's microscopic. How do you know it's microscopic? Because you can't see cells, right? There's no way that you can see a cell. You need a microscope. So a taste bud is what? The whole structure is microscopic in nature. You can't see these with your naked eye. But if you go to a mirror and stick your tongue out, you can see bumps on your tongue. Are those taste buds? Those aren't taste buds because what do you need to see a taste bud? You need a microscope to see it. So those bumps on your tongue are what we call papillae. And there's different kinds of papillae on different parts of your tongue. And lining the papillae are these taste buds. Right, so taste buds, you're going to have thousands of taste buds on a papillae or a papilla. Right, so these are microscopic things. And each taste bud might have, 100 of these different taste cells in it. But it's still a very, very small structure. Each one of these taste cells right here, so this taste cell is not a neuron. It's just a receptor cell that's going to produce generator potential. And each taste cell might respond to different kinds of stimuli. And here are what's pretty much agreed to are the five basic kinds of stimuli. These are sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and some amino acids that give us the sense of deliciousness. And that's what we call umami. All right, and so everybody laughs at that, like I don't know how to pronounce it or something. So if I'm mispronouncing it, you should tell me how to say it correctly, okay? And in particular, one amino acid is very strong in eliciting depolarization in a taste cell for amino acids, and that is glutamic acid or glutamate. Have you ever heard of like monosodium glutamate? Because it's a flavor enhancer that's placed in some foods, and not everybody can eat glutamates because it can be very powerful. Sometimes it can produce migraine headaches in certain people. Okay, so these are the five different primary taste sensations. So when you taste something, it's going to be some combination of these five primary senses that hopefully in your memory you can say, it's cherry flavor, or it's vinegar, or whatever. All right, so sour would be due to an acid. Right, so vinegar would have a sour taste in your mouth, and sweet would be due to what kind of molecule? Like sugar, some kind of sugar molecule, glucose, perfect example. Bitter would be, for instance, like quinine, what you have in tonic water, which is a bitter flavor, and that's different than sour, different than sweet. And salty, what does salty taste due to? Salt. Well, what's salt? It is sodium chloride. Right, so in particular, what we know now is due to sodium ions, right? Not necessarily chloride ions, but sodium ions. Right, sodium ions or hydrogen ions and acid interacting with these taste cells right here, which then are going to cause action potentials in the sensory nerve fiber, then carry these signals to the gustatory cortex for your appreciation of that particular taste modality. All right, but this is so cool. I'm going to at least show you this one last slide before we go. All right, so let's talk about two sensations, salty and sour. You don't need receptors on taste cells for salty and sour, but you do need ion channels. So you need channels, little protein channels. And in particular, if it's salt, guess what kind of channel this is? A sodium channel. So here's a sodium channel, and when you dump a bunch of sodium in your mouth, sodium is going to enter through this sodium channel onto this taste cell. And what's going to happen to the resting membrane potential of this taste cell? It's going to depolarize. And when it depolarizes, there are voltage-gated calcium channels on the membrane. Calcium enters, and this is just how we looked at neurotransmitter release at a synapse, that calcium is going to cause docking and fusing of an excitatory neurotransmitter, which is going to depolarize the sensory neuron, and that's going to send action potentials to the gustatory cortex. And it's going to go to what? The salty part of your cerebral cortex. And so you're going to have this sensation of salt. All right, so this neuron has got to go to the gustatory cortex specifically for salt. Now what about sour? Sour is due to acid. And what's acid? Hydrogen ions. And again, you don't need a receptor. All you need is a channel specifically for hydrogen ions. And when a hydrogen enters a cell, it causes depolarization. Because why? Because it's a cation, right? It's an acid molecule, but it's also a cation. That causes depolarization. And again, that depolarization opens calcium voltage-gated channels in this part of the cell, which causes fusion of these synaptic vesicles, releasing excitatory neurotransmitter, and that's going to depolarize this sensory neuron, taking that sense of sour to the gustatory cortex. Okay. So this is going to be an exam figure for you and the next test, okay? And then the other sensations, but we'll start here next time, are not due to ion channels. They're due to G-protein-coupled receptors in particular. So the mechanism is going to be a little bit different, but next time, because we've got to have a lecture on Tuesday, because your test is until Thursday. We'll talk about these. These G-proteins are going to cause the development of a second messenger in these cells, which is going to affect permeability of other kinds of ion channels in the cell, which eventually will cause release of excitatory neurotransmitter. So we'll start with this one next time. Okay. So sweet and umami due to a G-protein coupled receptor, as well as bitter. Okay, hope you all have a nice weekend.
On the last panel, we had questions that could take to each chapter. I had a feed on that. I'm going to tell them right now.
On the web? Yeah? The web questions, there's true, false, multiple choice, and I think fill in the blank, as well as some questions at the end of the textbook, too. Oh, my questions, a study guide. You know, I didn't make a study guide for this test. That helped a lot? Okay, I got to get motivated to do that again sometime. I won't have it. If I get it together, I'll email it to you. All right, but since I'm getting some feedback that is helpful, I guess I would like to do that. Yeah, just like write down my thoughts of what the important questions are. Yeah, okay.